If I already have the insight that I'm going to get to at the end of the essay, that's so boring for me. I don't want to know where it's going to end up. I don't want to know everything that the essay will know by the end.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Alyssa Washuta, whose book, White Magic, is a collection of essays that loops and folds, a book that begins with her frustration of occult trends that fetishize and imitate indigenous spiritual practices, and one that moves into an exploration of cultural inheritance, the dangers of living as an indigenous woman in the colonized world, and ultimately of her own desires, of love, and of meaning-making. Alyssa, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren.
Alyssa, would you mind reading a passage from White Magic?
I'd love to. Crying Room Door. I liked church because of the mysteries, sorrowful, joyful, glorious. I liked that my dad called one of God's three persons the Holy Ghost, like a character in a book of scary stories. In Catholic school, I learned that some supernatural truths could not be accessed through human reason. I took this to mean that God kept secrets like I did. My secrets were that I wanted to kiss the Ninja Turtles. I had a twin brother nobody could see, and I peed in the closet. God's secrets were about other worlds. In the New Testament, though, mysterion doesn't mean mystery. Something impossible or difficult to understand. It refers to what is mystical, with a spiritual meaning inaccessible without initiation. The priests said we could never understand how God impregnated Mary, how Jesus rose from the dead, or how Mary was pulled to heaven. But I was instructed in assumption before gravity, resurrection before biological death, an immaculate conception before reproduction. The problem with mystery is that I have always understood completely. I never fully cultivated a sense of reason in which what's called supernatural would be anything but natural. The church was dark, built from wood beams and black pillars. Off to the side, in the crying room, there was a statue of the Virgin. I wanted to be secreted inside with her. I cried through masses, hoping Mom would take Nate and me to that hiding place so I could watch the porcelain woman, in case she might weep with me. Forbidden Door. Before I was born, I was halved. New Age internet says many of us are this way, half hearts looking for completion. I've been looking for my lost parts forever, so I am never not serious in love. It could be anyone, I used to think. I just had to find him and lock myself into him. I tried so hard to force the fit that sometimes I barely noticed that the force had broken me. Something was different with Carl. I could listen to his thoughts and speak them back to him. We stared into each other's eyes, making a psychic rope. We knew we had to keep our bodies together as much as possible. Otherwise, our halves might pull apart again. I had never felt this way before. Until a year earlier, I had never felt much at all for very long because I could mostly submerge myself through intoxication. This meeting was fated. This was my other half. The intensity of my desire made me believe the divine had paired us, and I told him so. It had never been safe to tell a man I believed in something greater than myself, greater than him. It takes safety to dream, to play house in my mind, to build us a little life in the future, to believe we are living in magic and can use it to make us happy. I had to go away for a week, and soon after, Carl had to go away for three. We never returned to each other, not really. Every day, I change my mind about whether he's my missing half or whether I just want him to be.
You write a lot about riddles in this book, and even at the book's end, You write, I wanted this narrative, this one, this story, this riddle, this experiment, this trick, this device, to teach me to love right. But all I know is that I'm not sure I can love a man who wouldn't let me die. And maybe that means I can't love a man if I want to live. Has this book, has White Magic, changed the way you are alone with yourself?
I'm so glad that you read that particular passage, because that was really the moment of realization in writing this book, where I realized what I had been looking for in, you know, in just going through the sort of journey of the essay. It really was a process of pushing into mystery for me. And part of that, a big part of that, was having to be alone with myself and learning to be alone with myself, which I thought I was able to do before, you know, as a, you know, a true indoors child forever. But through the process of sitting with these problems to figure them out through writing essays, I realized where the discomfort was in being alone. And I just wrote and I wrote and I wrote like 100,000 words. And it was really when I got to writing that last essay, and in particular in writing those sentences that you read, when I realized what I had been avoiding looking at for so long was that this was the problem at the crux of my behavior and my existence for years, was that I was looking for something that was very, very bad for me. And I was not going to be able to continue trying to solve that problem by continuing it. And I think I wouldn't have gotten there without the process of writing the book.
Well, let's talk about this idea that there was something to come of the book, or there was this crux, this, you know, big understanding. Then many readers, just broadly, might presume that an author is an authority. And you kind of push against this notion in the book. I guess I should preface this for readers, that there are a number of black pages in White Magic, and many of these black pages present the same two quotes over and over. One is from the poet Alice Notley, and the other from Louise Erdrich. In a footnote to one of these repeated epigraph pages, you write, "When you don't understand the meaning of something you read, whose fault is it? Yours or the writer's? It has to be someone's fault. Everything does. Anyway, I just ask because this is my book. Do you think I understand everything in this book? If I don't, can you?" And my question, my original question that I drafted for you about that passage in particular, was, what do you now understand? But I guess after hearing you kind of talk about writing through the essay form and writing through the book, does there always have to be an understanding at the end of something like this, at the end of a process?
For me, yes. I don't want to say in general that that's true. But for me, the way the essay works in writing is that if I already have the insight that I'm going to get to at the end of the essay, that's so boring for me. I don't want to know where it's going to end up. I don't want to know everything that the essay will know by the end. You know, I don't do this to become wealthy. I would have done something else. I do this because I like it, and I get to make something that's exactly the thing I want to make. And the process remains a thing that's alive for me if it allows me to understand something I didn't before. The book has a lot of research, but I'm not an expert on witchcraft or astrology or colonialism or any of the things the book delves into. I'm using those things to feed my, you know, the meaning-making machine of my brain. And I think, yeah, I want to get somewhere different at the end than where I started. You know, and this is something that the book is concerned with as well. I think that the plot of this book is the plot of me working through understanding something. It's certainly not the plot of, you know, going through a breakup. That's kind of boring. Not for me, but for anybody reading about it, if that's all the book had been about. But, you know, the beginning, middle, and end, the hero's journey, the arc, whatever you want to call it, happened in my own brain. And so I've got to end up somewhere that's different than where I began.
How do you mentally and emotionally contend with the pace of the publishing industry? How does it change your relationship to your work and this work in particularly?
I think I learned a lot of things along the way about what I really wanted in terms of control of my own writing process. And not because of any one thing that happened, but mostly because of some wisdom I got along the way from other writers and things I observed about my own impatience, I realized what I wanted to do with this book was spend as much time as I needed to make it perfect. Absolutely perfect, as far as I was concerned. And, you know, it was perfect, but then it became perfect again after my editor went through it and made some suggestions and I made changes. It became really perfect after the fact check. But I'm digressing. Really, I feel very strongly that I want to have as much control as possible over the book for as long as I need to. So that really affected my publishing process. I did not sell this book on proposal. I thought about it, but I realized that it was not consistent with the process that I wanted to have of being totally alone with the book manuscript until I was completely ready to let someone else in and to do it at my own pace as much as possible. I am on the tenure track, but, you know, I wanted to keep it just mine for as long as I needed to, and I didn't want at any point to feel like I was being pressured to make the book into something that I didn't want it to be. I needed to figure out all of that on my own. So I just spent a long time with this book by myself. And once it was accepted for publication, the timeline was pretty short. It's gone by really fast. There's been a lot to do. You know, I did a little bit of revising, not any huge overhaul, some significant stuff, but it didn't take a super long time. And Tin House has taken such good care of this book, such good care of it. So there have been various stages of, like I said, copy editing, two rounds, fact checking, and, you know, the many other things that happen in the life of a book once it reaches the publisher. So we've been busy, and, you know, I spent a long time writing it. I started writing this in like 2012, I think.
Because it dovetails your personal experiences of rape and assault with appropriative practices of the occult, and because it speaks to these collaborative and shared research experiences and knowledge, many of these essays in the book, or even the book as a whole, really feels like a conversation, maybe even implicitly, about consent. Can you talk about the ways that consent is or is not given in white magic?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm thinking about, you know, back in my early 20s when I was working on my first book, and it's so much about trauma. And, you know, it's about rape. It's about being misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. And I was really suffering then. I mean, I was really just realizing what I'd been through and writing about it. And I was just experiencing new trauma and writing about it as it happened. And I think I felt like I wasn't fully in control of the process of writing a book and just being a writer in the world. I felt like I had to make craft decisions with the reader in mind, with the publishing industry in mind, you know, thinking about whether my book was ever going to sell, thinking about what books it could be compared to, who would my audience be. And I think I felt like I owed the reader something. And I also think that I felt like I needed to behave on the page in a certain way if I was going to have any success. And I don't want to draw an analogy here, but I do think it's not analogous. It's deeply connected to this feeling in me that I am obligated to other people. And, you know, I'm a few years older now, and I've grown so much and learned so much about boundaries. For the longest time, it wasn't working. The book was not coming together the way I wanted it to. It didn't feel right. It felt like I was doing what I thought was expected of me. And eventually, I just let that go. I became bitter about publishing. I became confident in myself. I started feeling really petty. That's really where the footnotes and the epigraphs came from. I just realized I wanted to make the book that I really, really wanted, and that I was not beholden to any readers. Because like I said, I am not looking to become mega wealthy off this book. I'm not doing it for commercial success. I know that that's not going to happen. I'm not Stephanie Meyer. That's just not what I'm doing. And I think with my first book, I was fooling myself into thinking that I was doing something other than what I was doing. And, you know, I think once I realized that what was more important than anything was to just make a book that really pleased me and that really contained all the things I wanted to see in a book. Once I really embraced that, I think it was really transformative for me. And that came along with a shift in other areas where I'm certainly not perfect in this, and I'm not even good with this at this point. But, you know, I do think I improved quite a bit when it comes to doing what other people want me to do when it goes against what I want to do. And I think this book is evidence of that, that I just needed to do something on my own terms.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Alyssa Washuta, author of White Magic. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Can you talk further about the ideas of collaborative and shared research and knowledge that you point to in the book?
I went into the subject of spirituality and appropriation knowing that so much of the non-Native approach to Native nonfiction has been really extractive. And certainly the approach to Native spirituality, which I talk about in the first essay, like including the over-harvesting of white sage, for example. And I know that this is something that readers sometimes want, sometimes expect, this divulging of information about Native spirituality. And I didn't care if that's what readers wanted. I cared so much more about following my own curiosity. And I just wasn't super interested in writing about that. A lot of that stuff is not to be shared with the reader. There's a large part of my spiritual life that is nowhere in this book because it doesn't belong there. And that, in some ways, created the shape and movement of this book. The initial offering of something about witchcraft and spirituality and appropriation pretty quickly falls away. And by the end, I've gotten to Twin Peaks and video games. And to me, you know, it wasn't a trick. It wasn't withholding. This is really where, this is the part of my spiritual life that I can share, is the ways that I generate and hold on to faith. and hope. And part of that was through Red Dead Redemption 2. So I was consciously working with the fact that I was going to begin by giving the reader what I thought they expected of me, and that I was going to let that fall away quickly and hoped that they would still be with me by the end.
So you use the past and a lot of these technologies and kind of cultural points as tools to understand your present and the person that you are now here. But these essays don't really consider nostalgia in a way that I might have expected. And perhaps this is, you know, again, to your wanting to kind of let go of reader expectations. But as a writer of nonfiction specifically and of memoir, what is your relationship to nostalgia? What do you see as being the relationship too between nostalgia, fear, and trauma?
Yeah, I don't think about nostalgia much. I think maybe in my mind, when that sort of impulse is activated, I just go looking for it. And that was really all over this book, you know, from the early essay where I think back to this video we would watch in Dare. I went looking for it. I never found it. When I think of Oregon Trail 2, I found a way to get it running on my super old computer. I bought the CD-ROM and set it up somehow so that I could play it. I think that I don't want to have that sad feeling of thinking about the past that's gone forever. It really does make me too sad. I mean, I have a hard time thinking about Seattle a lot of the time because that's gone. I don't live there anymore. But the Oregon Trail game, I can play that. I can go back to the books I loved as a child, the 11th Hour, the Dory books, so many of the books that I wrote about briefly in this book, like A Wrinkle in Time. I just went back to them because all of that, except for the Dare video, all of that is still available to me. I can't relate to it in the way I could as a child with that sort of sense of wonder and just that amazing feeling of something, you know, hitting me for the first time. But it's still great, and it's still available. It still exists.
I want to go back to those black pages with the epigraphs on them, specifically the repeated ones with Alice Notley and Louise Erdrich. The footnotes, like, you know, they do have kind of a peevish tone. The speaker, or you are kind of pressing a little bit. And in that pressing, I felt I read a suspicion of academia, how we are taught to read and read into literature. What's your relationship to academia? You're obviously a professor at The Ohio State University, but how does that relationship to academia inform, imbue, frustrate your creative work?
You know, I think it's less about academia and more about the literary world. I think some of that, you know, the parts where I'm talking about unlocking the meaning in a book and trying to figure out or decode a book and trying to really nail down the meaning, I don't feel like I see that in my academic world at this point. Yeah, I mean, you know, my colleagues are doing such fascinating things. I do think that in, you know, many high school English classes, from what I can tell, you know, educators are being sort of pushed toward some more simplistic ways of taking meaning from a text because of the direction that, you know, standardized testing has pushed K through 12 education to, from my understanding. I know that I experienced that in the wake of No Child Left Behind in high school when we made this sharp pivot toward the test. I feel like it became very important to master a text, to, you know, really decode the meaning of it. And I remember having an experience in high school of reading oh my God, what's the Kafka book where the guy's a bug?
Oh, Metamorphosis?
Yeah. We were reading that, and I had such a different understanding of that book than what we discussed in class. And I still remember sitting in the classroom and feeling like, oh my God, I feel like I didn't even read the same book as them. They have to be wrong. They must not have seen it. Whatever my interpretation of the text was, I don't remember at this point, but I know now very well that it was not the standard interpretation of that text. And I know that in college, in English classes, I also felt this anxiety of being pushed toward unlocking the meaning of a text and being able to say exactly what it's about. It's still something I struggle with. I still really struggle to describe what some essays are about in a way because I don't know that that's what I'm looking for when I'm reading. So yeah, in writing those footnotes that are pushing back against the idea of decoding a text or the certainty that some books are better than other books, I think I was really, to a small degree, speaking back to the teaching of literature in some settings. But really, I think what was driving that conversation I wanted to have with the reader, or the accusation I wanted to make, was that I think that there's really not enough acknowledgement in the literary world, in the publishing industry, of where the common conception of what's good comes from. And I feel that this book is good, and I feel that I know why, and I feel like I have a lot of intention around everything I did. And it may not work for all readers. In fact, it won't work for all readers. That's fine, though. It does have a relationship with academia in that I'm finishing my fourth year now at Ohio State, and I've learned so much from working with the students. One thing that immediately became very clear was that I am not the expert on their essays. I'm there to ask questions and to bring my expertise and talk to them about the way that I think effects can be achieved in essays, but I'm not everybody's ideal reader, and I don't know everything. I'm just one person among the rest of the people in the classroom who's giving feedback. I do have more knowledge and more experience than the other people in the room, but it doesn't mean that I know everything about their essay. So the footnotes were sort of speaking to that, that I made the choices that I made in this book very deliberately. And I know that they're not going to work for everybody, but that doesn't mean that they're bad. It just means that they don't work for somebody, and that's fine.
Alyssa, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
And congratulations on White Magic.
Thank you.
Look for more information about Alyssa at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.